Your next speaker is Lyndall R. Doty.
If you have your Bibles, let's turn together to 1 Peter chapter 2. We're going to begin looking at verse 11 of 1 Peter chapter 2 tonight. There is a great power in influence. There probably is no greater power than that of influence. With regard to influencing people for Christianity or against Christianity. I believe I mentioned last week to you the statement by Gandhi, who was asked the question, what is the greatest hindrance to Christianity in India? And he said, Christians. We might ask the same question up here. What is the greatest hindrance to Christianity in Warren County? Christians. Is that awful? That's true. What is the greatest hindrance to Christianity in Tennessee, or in the United States, or in the world? I fear that Christians are. There is a powerful evil in the wrong kind of influence. There is a powerful good in the right kind of influence. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 6, Paul talks about the wrong kind of influence. When he writes to the Corinthian church and says, your glorying is not good. Know ye not that a little leaven leaveneth the whole lump? And he's talking about the evil influence of one adulterous man in the church at Corinth. They were to separate themselves from that man, disfellowship him, that he may know his condition, and that the church may know that the church cannot and the Lord will not allow such to go on, and that the world may know that we are not involved in that kind of illicit activity. There is powerful good in the right kind of life. Jesus said that we are to let our lights shine, that men may see our good works and glorify our Father which is in heaven. When we bear fruit, we glorify God. John 15 and 8. And we are salt of the earth. And when we are the proper salt, when we influence in a proper way, we're an influence for good in our communities, and we are like salt in that respect. But if the salt has lost its savor, it's not good for anything to be cast out and trodden under the foot of men. If the light stops shining, if it's put under a bushel or hid under a bed, then it's of no good. It's no effect in the world of darkness. Christians must shine forth as lights in the world of darkness. We must illuminate, as Paul would say in Philippians 2. The Christian uses his life and his influence for the glory of God. In verse 12 of 1 Peter 2, having your behavior seemly among the Gentiles, that wherein they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works, which they behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. Here is this idea of the light shining and glorifying God because the light shines. In this lesson tonight, we will notice four areas of life that Peter mentions, beginning in verse 11 through chapter 3 and verse 7. Four areas that the life of the Christian touches, and in which really the Christian preaches a sermon by his life. So the title of the lesson tonight is that a Christian is one whose life is a sermon, because it is. Paul would say, in fact, that the Christian's life is an epistle written in the hearts of men to be read of all. Is your life a sermon? What does your life preach as a sermon? There are four areas that Peter talks about that the sermon must be preached, and it will be preached either bad or good. First of all, in a general way, I believe we find in verse 11 that he says that the Christian is one whose life is indicative of abstaining from fleshly lusts, which war against the soul. Notice that Peter says, Beloved, I beseech you as sojourners and pilgrims to abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. What are fleshly lusts? The word lust literally means uncontrolled desire. The uncontrolled desire which brings forth sin and ultimately results in death. James 1, 13-16. Fleshly means of the human nature, apart from God. Life without the standards of help, of grace, and the influence of Christ. To be solely involved and only involved in the flesh. Paul lists some sins in Galatians chapter 5 that are sins of the flesh. They are the fleshly lusts which war against the soul. Notice the characteristics of them. Fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, sorcery, enmities, strife, jealousies, wraths, factions, divisions, parties, envyings, drunkenness, revelings, and such like, of which I forewarn you, even as I did forewarn you, that they who practice such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. Peter says the Christian is one who abstains from fleshly lusts, which war against the soul. It includes sexual lusts, but it includes much more than that. It's broader than that. It deals with any area of life which involves the flesh, in which one gives himself over or is inclined to give himself over or involves himself in those activities which would cause himself to give himself over to fleshly lusts. It might be put this way in a syllogistic or in an argument form. All fleshly lusts, this passage says in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 11, all fleshly lusts which war against the soul are things from which a Christian must abstain, or activities from which a Christian must abstain. And then you can put a blank in the next sentence and say, blank is a fleshly lust which war against the soul. And your conclusion would be then, blank is a thing from which a Christian must abstain. And you could list every one of those things mentioned in Galatians chapter 5 and say, where a Christian is to abstain from all fleshly lusts which war against the soul, fornication is a fleshly lust which wars against the soul, therefore a Christian must abstain from fleshly lust, or a Christian must abstain from fornication, or fornication is a thing from which a Christian must abstain. And you could do every one of those things that way. That's what Peter's talking about. The Christian then will not involve himself in any kind of activity which will help him engage in those things which are fleshly lusts. He separates himself. This is the one negative aspect of this sermon that Peter here says that the Christian is to preach. There's always a negative side to Christianity, but there's always a positive side. We'll notice the positive in the next three. But here he mentions these. We must remove the negative. We must get rid of the sin in our lives. We must be living before others that they do not see the fleshly lust that they see in others, in us. When they observe us, they do not see the same kind of worldliness. They do not see the same kind of giving oneself over to self-indulgence that they see in those round about them who are of the world. The Christian then will not feed his mind on pornography. He'll not read books and magazines which are designed to arouse lusts, because he's to abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. The Christian will turn off lewd television programs that he may observe, watch something else if he has to watch anything, because there are things which tend to fleshly lust, which war against the soul. The Christian will not attend X-rated or adult-only movies which involve themselves in creating an atmosphere of lustful tendencies. He will abstain from those kinds of things. Why? Because they're fleshly lusts which war against the soul. He will not participate in the modern dance for the same reason, because they tend to fleshly lusts which war against the soul. And young people need to be aware of the fact that they do that. You know, I think preachers hesitate to preach on dancing because a lot of young people consider them to be old fogies if they do. But call me that if you like. I happen to have been in that situation a few years ago, and I know from experience that it creates fleshly lust which war against the soul. I don't like to watch some of these weird African type music, the drums and the heavy beat and the disco kind of mania type thing. Not only that, I understand more doctors are saying all the time that it's harmful. I know that may be questionable, because some people question the fact that smoking is harmful or drinking is harmful. But there are some who are very serious about the fact that it causes deafness and a lack of hearing on the part of the young people who are listening to that real heavy and loud music. But anyhow, the modern dance with the movements that are involved, separate or together, create fleshly lusts which war against the soul among young people who have no right to have those kinds of thoughts with those with whom they're dating or dancing, as the case may be. The Christian will not involve himself or indulge in promiscuous petting. Young people have a tendency, because of their youth and because of their desires and the pent-up emotions that they have, which will eventually be fulfilled in marriage, have a tendency to pet. I hope that those who are Christians will strive to understand that that's not something which they can be engaged in without sin. It's the fleshly lust which wars against the soul. He will strive to love instead of hate and envy and jealousy. He will cultivate self-control in his relationship to others. He will not allow himself to be tempted to drink or to revelings, for they are fleshly lusts which war against the soul. His motives for abstaining from these fleshly lusts are very simple, really. He's motivated because he knows that they war against his own soul. And the soul is more valuable than all the world, Jesus said in Matthew 16:26. For he says, what would a man gain if he should gain the whole world and lose his soul? What would he gain? Wouldn't gain anything, because you can't take it with you when you go. You can be buried in your Cadillac or your Continental. You can be buried with your money as a pillow, but you still can't take it with you when you go. He is motivated because he recognizes that he's a sojourner in the world, as is pictured here in verse 11. He's a sojourner. He's only a passer-through. He is not permanent on this world, but he has a citizenship that's someplace else. He has a home that's prepared for him, a heavenly home, a heavenly land, a citizenship and a commonwealth which is in heaven, as is pictured in Philippians 3, verse 20 and 21. So then he's a pilgrim, a passer-through on this earth, here but for a brief moment, as James would say, like a vapor that appeareth for a little while and then vanishes away. But eternity will be forever. And so he's motivated not to involve himself in those things which ruin his soul, which will live forever. He is aware of the opportunity to use his influence for doing good. And so he does good because he knows that evildoers even can speak well of him if he does well, as is pictured in verse 12. He loves God, and because he loves God, he desires to please him. John says in 1 John 2, verse 3 to 6, that if any man says he knows God, he knows there's one way he can prove it, or one way he can show that he knows God. And one way you can know whether he knows God, he keeps his commandments. It's not that difficult to know whether a person knows God or not, or whether a person is a Christian or not. It's very simple, really, relatively. Does he keep the commandments of God? A man who says he's a Christian, a man who says he is right with God, a man who says he's a member of the body of Christ and then does not live in harmony with the will of God is not what he claims. Just that simple. He doesn't know God, and he does not know a right relationship with him. The person who is a Christian loves Jesus and knows he must keep his commandments in order to prove that he loves him. John 14:15, if you love me, keep my commandments. Now notice the second thing that the second area that Peter says that the Christian must prove himself or must show himself a sermon. He must preach a sermon in his relationship to government, his citizenship. How does he relate to government authority? Be subject unto every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme or as unto governors as sent to him for vengeance on evildoers, and for praise to them that do well. For so it is the will of God that by well-doing ye should put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free and not using your freedom as a cloak of wickedness, but as bondservants of God. Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Christians were often falsely accused in the New Testament time of being lawbreakers. And frequently we're reminded that we are not to be lawbreakers. We're not to involve ourselves in breaking the laws of the land. We're not to be accounted as lawbreakers in that sense. We're to obey the laws of the land. We're to submit ourselves to those who have authority, for this is the will of God. The Christian who says, I'm a faithful Christian, but refuses to obey the laws of the land is not a faithful Christian. We as citizens of our country and our community need to be concerned about being lawful people. Lawful people. We obey the laws of the land because they are ordained of God. Romans chapter 13, verse 1, and also here. Even to the extent that we agree with those with whom we may want to disagree, and yet we are willing to submit to their will because they have, as government authorities, the power of God, even for vengeance on evildoers who may do that which is wrong. Christians recognize civil authority as sanctioned then of God, and they're willing to submit to that authority. Romans 13, 1, Titus chapter 3, verse 1, both teach us to submit to the authority which is ordained of God. Now, we're not talking about a specific government or specific individuals. I think we need to understand that Paul here is saying that government itself, that is higher powers, have authority from God. It was God's intention that there not be anarchy among men. Without rules and regulations, there is anarchy. And so God ordained the government of men and over men be put into power. It may be monarchy, it may be democracy, it may be republic, it may be something else. But it's given for the control of men that they may do that which is right and good. In order to obey God, one must respect civil authorities. Our submission to those civil authorities would put to silence those who would speak evil against us, he says, that we might put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. There were those who claimed that Christians had were breaking all kinds of law. Many of them were evildoers. They were simply speaking against good and righteousness. But some of them just misunderstood Christians. For instance, they were accused of cannibalism. Did you know that? Early New Testament Christians were accused of cannibalism. They were accused so because it was rumored that when they came together at night, they actually ate the body of somebody. Can you imagine where they got that idea? And drank the blood of their God. The next step then for people to misunderstand the partaking of the Lord's Supper was to assume that it was literal blood and literal bread or literal flesh. They were accused of such. They were accused of refusing to obey the laws of the emperor because they refused to worship him. They refused to sprinkle a little altar on the incense, a little incense on the altar and say, Kyrios Kaiser, Lord Caesar. They refused to do that. And to not do that was the same thing as far as the people of Rome were concerned as refusing to obey the governor. They were put in a dilemma, weren't they? So they were accused of many things, and we could list other things as well. They were accused of setting fires. Nero planned that and accused the Christians of setting Rome on fire when he sought to burn the city himself. And other things have been accused of. And so Peter writes to the Christians and says, now, you need to be doing good that you might put the evildoers to silence because they're ignorant. They're foolish men. They do not know whereof they speak. And so by our good life, we must discredit those who speak against us. And today, we must do the same thing. There will be those who will discredit Christians. They'll discredit them because of envy. They'll discredit them because of jealousy. They'll discredit them because they just don't like Christians. They'll discredit them because they just don't like the power that a Christian may have or the influence that a Christian may have. And people will use all kinds of tools that are evildoers and wicked men and foolish men to speak against those who are trying to do that which is right. I think that's been the case in our community with some of our own brethren, where men have spoken evil against men who have tried to do that which is good and right. Be careful, brethren, that we do not fit in the category of foolish men and evildoers who speak about things which we have misunderstood. These Christians were spoken evilly of because they were misunderstood. They did not understand their actions. But Peter says, by our lives, we must let people know. By our actions, we must let those who are even evildoers, who would speak evil against us, have no reason to speak evil of us. The Christian recognizes one law is superior to the government. One law is higher. And that is the law of God. The apostle said in Acts 5 and 49, we must obey God rather than men. If it comes to that point where we have to make the choice, then our choice is clear. We must obey God rather than men. Now, the third area that the Christian's life is a sermon is in the area of business or in the area of his everyday work situation. Now, in 18 through 25, we have pictured here the servant-master situation. I'm just going to pick out a few passages as highlights. Servants, be in subjection to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the froward, that is, the forceful and obstinate. For this is acceptable, if for conscience toward God a man endureth griefs and suffereth wrong. For what glory is it when ye sin and are buffeted? For it ye shall take it patiently. But if, when ye do well and suffer for it, ye shall take it patiently, this is acceptable with God. And then he goes ahead and talks about that this is the example that Jesus gave us. And we are to follow in his footsteps. Who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he was harmed, did not harm in return. And he could have. But rather, showed us an example of enduring with a gentle spirit and meekness. The principles outlined in the New Testament call for respect. They call for respect of servants to masters and masters to servants. And in our situation, in a parallel situation today, we would have to say that in our workaday situation, that the New Testament demands that the employee respect his employer, and that the employer respect his employee. The household duties that are sometimes pictured include the servant-master relationship because they were so closely tied to the workaday situation. And in Ephesians chapter 5, and also in Colossians chapter 3, you have these pictured, and if you'd like a further detailed study of them, you may look at those passages, especially beginning in Colossians 3:17 and in Ephesians chapter 5. The employer must have certain responsibilities to his employee. If he's a Christian employer, he has a responsibility to see that his employee is paid properly, that he's paid on time, that he's paid adequately for his service, that he does not shortchange him or anything of this nature. In fact, James gives us a warning in James chapter 4 to say that the rich man who held back the salary of a man who worked for him, that would end up being a judgment against him in the judgment. That it will be used as a means of judgment to weigh against his life on the earth. So the employer has a serious responsibility of treating his employees because they too are God's people. And they too, in the case of two Christians, are Christians. They're brothers in Christ. And in the case of the employee, with his respect to the employer, even if he's froward, even if he's forceful and unkind at times, Peter says, well, if you have to suffer for doing good, then you can will receive a reward after a while. And if you go ahead and do what you do, and do it well, then you're going to receive the reward that is coming, that will come from God. The New Testament teaches then respect on both parts. The New Testament teaches the dignity of work. For all is done by the glory of God and for the glory of God. Whatever you do, do not to be seen of men, he says, but that rather that it be done for the glory of God. We do not work for money. Now, we get money for work. We do not work for personal prestige. We may obtain it. We do not work for the master or for the employer. We work for God. Now, that's hard for us to get across, I think. I think it's hard for us to understand that. That what we do, whatever our hand finds to do, we ought to do with all of our mind. What we eat, what we drink, what we say, what we involve ourselves in as far as activities are concerned, all must be done to the glory of God, 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 31. We do not do things for eye pleasers as servers of men, but rather we do that which is pleasing unto God, to serve Him. And these passages in Colossians and Ephesians very plainly point that out. Our work is done for God. So our life should be a sermon in our relationship to business. The Christian is the best employee. Because he's serving the Lord in his work. He's not doing it to be pleasing unto the employer, although that may be the case if he is doing good and working well. But he does it because he's a servant of God. The employer is the best employer who's a Christian. Because he has the principles and the teaching of Jesus Christ behind him to motivate his actions toward his employees. I'm convinced, just as firmly as I'm standing here today, that the best employer is a Christian. And the best employee is a Christian. And if they're not, they're not what they ought to be as Christians. It's just that simple. Their life is not the sermon that it ought to be. Peter says, let us do it. If we have to suffer, employees, with a froward employer, then let us suffer in peace. Let us suffer, knowing that we'll receive a just recompense of reward for our suffering, just as Jesus did. And he's our example. Now, fourthly, there is power in the godly life in the home. The Christian is to preach a sermon in the home. He's to preach a sermon in a negative way to the world. Fleshly lust, he's not to involve himself in, which war against the soul. He is to be in subjection as a good citizen to the government. He is a good citizen in his community. A Christian must be a good citizen. He preaches a sermon to that effect. The Christian must be a good employer or employee. He preaches a life in his business relationships, or preaches a sermon in his business relationships. But the Christian also preaches a sermon in his home. And that's what Peter talks about in 1 Peter chapter 3. In like manner, ye wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that even if any obey not the word, they may without the word be gained by the behavior of their wives, beholding your chaste behavior coupled with fear. Whose adorning let it not be the outward adorning of braiding the hair, or of wearing of jewels and gold, or of putting on of apparel, but let it be the hidden man of the heart and the incorruptible apparel of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. The woman can win her husband if she speaks the words and the words do not influence him. If she tries to teach him and the gospel will not bring him to conversion. If the non-believer will not believe by the teachings that she can give him through the scriptures, then Peter says, don't despair. But you live before him in such a way that your manner of life and your behavior, which is godly, will result in the conversion of that husband who's a non-believer. Now you say, well, those poor ladies really have a responsibility. The husbands do as well. In verse 7, ye husbands, in like manner, you're to have the same kind of relationship to your wife as she is supposed to have to you if you're a Christian and she's not. Dwell with your wives according to knowledge, giving honor to the woman as unto the weaker vessel, as being also joint heirs of the grace of life, to the end that your prayers be not hindered. The godly life of a person in a home will influence not only one another's mates, but also influence for life and eternity the lives of the children. We have a responsibility in our homes to live a life which is a sermon. Live a life which can be read and seen of men. The best argument for Christianity is a real Christian.